Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
May is Maytag Month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle this Tuesday. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Peachy.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
As always, thank you to everyone who is listening on Tuesday for helping to keep this thing afloat. You are not going to want to miss our summer preview episode this Thursday. We got lots of interesting movies on the horizon. There's some spectacular bombs coming up, but also some possible really big hits. We're going to go through what we're most excited for, non-Odyssey edition. I'm just telling you now, guys, before we tape that episode, you can't pick the Odyssey for any of the categories. We're going to do plenty of, we've got plenty of Odyssey buzz on this show already. It's forbidden. I forbid
that's
it.
Fake.
All right. Anyway, on to controversies and non-controversies. Would you, there we go. Now I'm pointing at the camera. Would you, consumer of this show, pay $50 for a movie ticket? Not to a premiere, mind you, or a special event where the actors and directors show up to glad hand and talk to folks in the crowd. No, just a regular screening of The Odyssey, say, in New York City. Regal bet the answer to this was yes, and their bet has paid off. That's the price the chain charged for 70mm IMAX showings of Dune Part 3. Which is opening in December, it's opening in the 70mm IMAX format and many other formats. But the 70mm IMAX shows at the $50 price point have basically sold out in a matter of moments. Here is Ben Fritz in the Wall Street Journal. Quote, Regal sold its inventory of $50 Dune tickets projected in 70mm IMAX film in a matter of minutes, since premium auditoriums regularly sell out fastest. Exhibitors are racing to build more of them. AMC, the biggest chain in the United States, had 517 at the end of last year, 30% more than in 2021. In addition, AMC charges adds a surcharge of up to $2 a ticket for popular films on their opening weekends. End quote. All right, this is a very simple story, really. It's just supply and demand. That's all it is. There are only a handful of 70mm IMAX screens in the entire world. There are fewer in the country. Dune Part 3, along with similar films like The Odyssey, will only play in these theaters for a couple of weeks, thanks to IMAX deals regarding new releases. And by the way, this is one of the most frustrating things about these movies, is that you have something like Interstellar, which sold out for weeks on end, and then they replaced it with some other just random IMAX movie that didn't do nearly the business. It's very, just keep the 70mm IMAX things in the 70mm IMAX auditoriums. Anyway, and as a result, the tickets sell out pretty fast. Then they wind up on the resale market, going for much more than their initial price. Regal, therefore, is trying to capture more of the money, which in turn will be shared with the studios, which will in turn be shared with the filmmakers. Tickets to see Interstellar in IMAX 70mm, which largely sold out during its re-release last year, were $25 a pop. Not cheap. That's not cheap. That's more expensive than even your average new release, right? And that's a lot of money for a decade-old film. You know what it did? It sold out. It sold out like every show. I ended up having to see it on Wednesday at 10 in the morning or something because I didn't get tickets ahead of time because I'm an idiot. I'm a dummy. Anyway. I think this is a good thing. I think it's a good thing. And yet I can understand why some, including Sony's Tom Rothman and even AMC's Adam Aaron, are a little bit nervous about this. The problem with charging these sorts of prices for tickets, even for tickets in a premium large format like 70mm IMAX, the problem is that it creates this image of film going as something of an elite experience, more akin to the opera than a normie activity for normie audiences looking for something to do on a Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. Now, there are some filmmakers out there who have argued that this is the inevitable future of movie going, right? George Lucas has kind of been on this beat for a while. He has suggested for a long time that the future of movies is you'll have something play in a theater for a few weeks in one of the 10 theaters that's left in the country, and people will pay $100 to see it, and then it'll be on streaming and video on demand or whatever. But it does, that's possible. Maybe that's true. But maybe the real answer here is to increase the number of venues capable of showing 70 millimeter IMAX and then monkey with the release dates a little bit so the runs aren't quite as limited. I'm sorry, if you can't build a contract where the 10 screens that are built for 70 millimeter IMAX play those movies for longer than, again, The Mandalorian and Grogu when it hits IMAX, you're failing the customers. You're failing your business model. Regardless, the future of film itself does seem to be PLF, right? Premium large format. It's why Netflix is committing to a 49-day theatrical window for their forthcoming Narnia movie. It was the only way to get Regal to sign off on allowing the film on their biggest and best screens. And then it's also like after the period in time where they were going to be in the holiday season, the studios were real annoyed. They're like, why are you giving the best screens to Netflix, which is trying to kill you all the time? Anyway, solved a lot of problems moving it to February. Peter, is this $50 price tag for tickets unreasonable? Is this gouging by Regal Cinemas? Are they hurting the consumer with this? Or is it just the inevitable result of supply and demand?
Pretty much definitionally, if people are paying it, it's reasonable. I mean, this just goes back to our art discussion, our NFTs discussion. Value is what people will pay for it. And if people weren't paying it, then it wouldn't be worth $50. It's clearly worth $50 because many people are paying it. These things are actually these tickets are going pretty quickly. But this is an inevitable transformation of this industry as it is undergoing something has happened in it, in other industries as well, but just sort of as we are seeing changes in movies. And it goes back a long ways, right? Like this is, you mentioned George Lucas talking about the need to have higher movie ticket prices, but it's not just George Lucas. James Cameron has been beating this drum for decades. I mean, I can't remember the first time I heard him say this, but he's basically like, it's actually a problem that very expensive movies of the kinds that James Cameron makes charge the same amount as very cheap movies. And he thought, I want to say back in the 90s, I could be getting my dates wrong, but he thought that movie ticket prices should be much higher for big, expensive tentpole films. We are not quite seeing charging based on the cost of the film here, but what we are seeing is Dune is an expensive movie. It's certainly not a cheap one. And we are seeing the price increase based on the availability of this specific screen technology. And this just doesn't strike me as a problem at all. It would be a problem if theaters and studios and sort of the movie industry thought they were going to make money this way and it wasn't working. But you look at something like the bourbon industry, which is also having some problems right now, but which went through this huge boom starting in the aughts through about 2022. And a big part of what was going on with bourbon is just there's a lot more increase in demand. But as demand increased overall, demand for pricey products in particular, for kind of a long age or sort of specially finished products, really shot up. And so what you saw is a strategy starting really in the early aughts, but then predated that, but kicking off through the 2010s in particular, of what they called premiumization. And so the brands were just making much, much more money by charging customers who had the money and were willing to pay an awful lot more. You know, I mean, in 2000 or so, GQ and Esquire would run articles about like, what's the best $30 bottle of bourbon? Because a $30 bottle of bourbon wasn't maybe literally the best you could get, but they're just like, that was a fairly premium bottle. And by 2015, there were quite a few of these, even large producers, not just specialty producers, selling $150 bottles of bourbon, or in some cases, quite a bit more than that. And so this is how sort of economies develop, right? Like the bourbon example is actually kind of apt here, because bourbon for a very long time was just a kind of cheap staple for the masses. And then what happened was, as demand is sort of increased, but then also changed and people got richer, those companies realized that the hardcore fans, and yeah, you would call them alcoholics, right? But like, in fact, many of the people are not actually drinking this stuff. right? Many people are just buying to collect, in some cases, stupidly to collect for the price increase, right? Like they're treating them as investments, which I think is a bad idea. But what they were able to do was sort of extract more money out of those people. That is the same thing that's happening here. If they ever build a 70 millimeter theater, sorry, a 70 millimeter IMAX, we have 70 millimeter in DC and we have IMAX in DC, but we do not have a place where you can normally see 70 millimeter IMAX projections of Hollywood films in the Washington area. If they ever build one, I will happily pay $50 if that's what it takes to get a seat to see Dune 3 or something like it. Or the Odyssey, which I know we're not allowed to talk about.
Yes, we're not allowed to discuss this yet. Alyssa, what do you make of this? It's funny because there's a moment in the movie we're going to be discussing a little bit later, the Devil Wears Prada 2, where one of the characters talks about, you know, how they used to struggle to get somebody to pay $150 for a purse, and now they charge $3,000 for a purse, and there's still plenty of people out there who buy them. But it does create, I can't help but think it creates some resentments. It creates some concerns on the part of consumers. Well, if I can't afford to see it in this best format, should I even bother seeing it at all? I do wonder if there's a limit here that they're going to hit.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, this is not something that is discussed in the Devil Wears Prada, but there is a whole economy of dupes, fakes, bags you can rent. There's actually a new premium like membership service that allows you to rent an Hermes bag. And so, you know, look, I would probably pay $50 four times a year to see a IMAX 70 millimeter movie in DC, right? Like my alternative is driving to King of Prussia, which like, if you value your time and energy, and especially if you have small children and therefore have to pay for babysitting, it would cost me a hell of a lot more than $50 a ticket to see a movie in that format with my husband.
On the other hand, maybe we need an across the movie aisle road trip to King of Prussia.
Oh, be so good. That or we should all meet at the...
There's one in Dallas. There's one like 10 miles from my house.
So
come to my house.
Peter, should we drive to Sunny's house to go see The Odyssey and Dune 3?
Dallas
Maybe
is a
this
long drive,
happen.
But they do have airplanes.
It's true. There are many options for us.
And one thing that airplanes do, just notably, is they charge more for better seats, even when it's basically the same seat.
Yeah. And so, look, people are going to make their own decisions about these formats. I would happily pay more for more of these theaters to exist, right? I mean... Yeah, the difference to me, I paid $17.95 a ticket to see Devil Wears Prada at my neighborhood theater in DC, which is a nonprofit. And it's, you know, it's not premium large format. It's a really lovely old fashioned theater in some ways, but the masking and the sound aren't always perfect. And so if I'm already paying $20 for an experience that's in my neighborhood that, you know, is sweet, but like fundamentally lo-fi, I'm already a lot of the way there. To seeing a more expensive movie on a more expensive screen. And so, you know, as long as these movies are available in more than one format, in more than one kind of theater, and there's nothing wrong with charging more for the premium experience. I just can't get worked up over it.
I mean, the alternative to this is just that somehow or another movies become a mass phenomenon again, right? The old model of pricing only works when basically, not everybody, but when huge numbers of people just kind of automatically go to the movies every week, and then you can charge $7 or $15 or whatever, you know, I paid $7 a ticket for evening screenings when I was a kid, right? And that worked because people just kind of went, and it was just sort of assumed. And there was, right, there you yes, the... marketing had, you know, it was different than in the 1940s or 50s. There were fewer people in the 90s, but like there were just many more kind of butts in seats automatically for almost anything. And so that created a world in which you could just charge a sort of simple flat fee for everything. And what movies need to survive, what theaters in particular need to survive right now, are increased sources of revenue. And they can pull that out of the tickets. They can pull that out of, right, you know, the ticket prices, and hopefully they'll give you something for it. Better sound, a bigger screen, a 70 millimeter projection, or they can, you know, raise food prices. The Alamo is in part a play to generate more revenue through food sales because they keep all of that, unlike the ticket prices, right? And so it's just, there's just no other world in which if you're going to have a declining customer base, then those people need to pay more.
Yeah, but the flip side of this is, look, supply and demand is a two-way street, right? You have supply and you have demand. If you have more demand, you can create more supply.
Yes.
Just build more of these theaters. Build, like, this is the thing that drives me craziest. And I understand, look, building a 70-millimeter screen is not cheap. There's the cost of projector. And you have to build a big auditorium. These are not things that you can really stick in most multiplexes as they are configured now. You would have to combine some spaces. You would have to raise ceilings, raise roofs.
It's also just like ridiculously expensive to ship those prints. Like people
But that's all built into the cost. It costs an insane amount of money to strike one of these 70 millimeter IMAX prints and ship it and everything. But like, again, this is, you know, once they're out there, they're there. It's, you know, anyway. And you can charge so much more. Again, the I did some back of the envelope math on the Interstellar release when it came out, and those screens were generating some insane. It was like $120,000 a day or something. Like it was a ridiculous amount of money. So like the money is there. You just have to have the capability to show it. And this is what drives me crazy when I hear Marvel and Disney coming up with this ridiculous Infinity Vision thing. Oh, we're gonna certify some of the larger screens as Infinity Vision, and that, you know, those are gonna be as good as the other premium large format. Like, no, first of all, you're diluting the rest of the, like, this is a separate question about like what happens to movie theaters when people only want to go see premium large format stuff, which I think is actually very bad for the health of the theatrical industry as a whole. But like this kind of like fake, even faker IMAX that they're doing is insane. Like, no, don't do that. Don't do that.
Except no substitutes.
Build actual places to go.
Yeah.
So I agree with the fake IMAX thing. That is definitely a kind of a sign of desperation on Disney Marvel's part with the new Avengers film. But I slightly disagree about whether it is bad to generate excitement mostly about premium large format, because the problem has been, at least since the pandemic, that there just hasn't been any excitement at all. And I'd rather have excitement about this one specific thing that shows people how great movies can be in a spectacular format. And the fact that it is generating this kind of demand and interest, that even if it's amongst a small group of people who are willing to shell out $50, that is a good sign. You need a hardcore enthusiastic base of super fans for the industry to survive. And in any case, the smaller screens, like the ones that I saw, Sonny, you and I both spent a couple of years of our lives, you fewer than me, in a town called Niceville, Florida. And there was a Twin Cinemas in the strip mall there with two screens that did get new releases. They tended to get whatever was big and whatever was family friendly. And I think back on the size of those screens, they're bigger than my 77-inch television, but they're not that much bigger, right? And this is, I mean, they're not that, like, and especially with how close I sit to my TV, the sort of the way that my big TV now takes up a field of vision. The point is that people now have options to watch in their home, in their basements, in their living rooms, to watch movies at the caliber that was common in movie theaters in the 1990s. And so if you want to get people off their butts and off their couches out to the theaters, you are going to have to deliver a bigger, more spectacular experience like 70 millimeter.
This is incorrect, and size queening these theater screens is the wrong way to go about getting people back.
I like a little movie in a little theater. I am a fan of this. The Avalon that Alyssa mentioned, that old historic theater up in up the Red Line, up Connecticut Avenue. It's great theater. Great theater. It's really beautiful, and it's not gigantic. It's just a nice space, but that's not going to be enough for a lot of people, and you know it.
I agree that it's not enough for a lot of people, because when they go to theaters, they say, I want to see the IMAX. A lot of the times there is no IMAX version of whatever movie they want to go see, because there's only one movie showing an IMAX at a time. It's a problem, and if theaters continue to push this solution to the problem, they are just going to end up burning themselves out, because there are only so many big screens like that. All right. So what do we think?
They're going to build more spheres. They're going to build more spheres. They're going to build more of these things. We're going to leapfrog 70 millimeter, go past that. At some point, the entire atmosphere, just you're going to look up in the sky and it's going to be one big screen.
That sounds pretty great, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't
pay
50
bucks for
that anyway. The sky is for idiots. All right. So what do you think? Is it controversy? Is charging $50 for a 70 millimeter IMAX film ticket a controversy or a non-controversy? Alyssa?
It's a non-controversy.
Peter?
I think the sky is a controversy. We got to replace it with a screen immediately.
Sky is garbage. All right. It's a non-controversy, but a better solution would be to build like 500 more of these 70 millimeter IMAX screens. Maybe not that many. Maybe you could just have one per major city. That would be great. Just have one in every major city. Everybody could
this
be
is
as
how
cool
you know
as
that
Dallas
DC,
and King of Prussia.
This is how you know that DC is not a major city, because we don't have a 70 millimeter IMAX.
So we do have these two 70 millimeter screens at the Smithsonian's that don't play the big films anymore. And I don't know what happened there, because I saw Interstellar in 70 millimeter.
It has something to do with the projectors they have there. The fact that the Smithsonian's don't have the capability to play 70 millimeter IMAX is silly, and they should fix that. But it's a problem for another day, I guess. All right, make sure to swing by Thursday for our special summer preview. It's always a fun episode. I can't wait to let you guys know what we're most excited for, non-Odyssey edition. I swear to God, one of you is going to say the Odyssey and you're going to think it's a funny joke, and I'm going to fly to D.C. and I'm going
to
burn your house down, because I'm
you'll
not
come
joking
to DC
around
if
on
I
this.
Say the Odyssey?
Not joking around on this. All right, now on to the main event.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The Devil Wears Prada 2, set 2 decades after the first. We open on the original film's Andy, who's played once again by Anne Hathaway, winning a prestigious journalism award on the same day her entire investigative reporting team is laid off. Real rip from the headline stuff here. Fired up about the lack of respect for her team's journalism, she goes on an epic rant that goes viral and results in a call from Irv Rabbitz, head of the Elias Clark publishing empire that owns Runway, the Vogue-like magazine at which Andy worked in the first film. Runway is in a bit of trouble, you see, as Miranda Priestly, who is once again played by Meryl Streep, foolishly signed off on a piece about a fast fashion house that utilizes slave labor, and they're canceled. They're getting canceled on the internet. It's a thing that happens to magazines. Andy has been hired without Miranda's advice or consent to stand up a features desk that will help turn things around. And it's up to Nigel, played again by Stanley Tucci, to help her weather the storm. I'm a fan of the original. Sometimes people seem surprised when I tell them I actually really enjoy the original Devil Wears Prada. I think it's a lot of fun. And it's also like, it's secretly a sports movie. Maybe we can have that discussion. But like, it's a really good movie, and it's entertaining, and it's like a nice little slice of life. It's a good journalism movie. But it was a good journalism movie because it made great use of Runway's very specific mode of journalism, that is the world of high fashion, to make broader points about the importance of art and culture and just like excellence in general. It does one thing very well, that original, which is use a specific setting to tell a more universal story about young people in cities and the awfulness of mean bosses and the importance of staying true to oneself rather than excelling professionally at any cost, yada, yada, yada. It's a movie that is quite literally about temptation. The devil is real, and it's Miranda Priestly, and about the need to save one's soul, all told through the lens of a magazine that determines which shade of blue is going to populate your sweater drawer 2 seasons from now. The Devil Wears Prada 2, meanwhile, is much more generic. Yes, Runway is still a fashion magazine. Yes, the closing set piece takes place on a Milan runway. But Runway could be any magazine in the modern era. of dwindling ad spends and click-driven writing. The entire subplot involving the potential sale of Runway and the jockeying between Irv's son, who's a finance bro played by BJ Novak, and a tech billionaire of the Elon Musk Jeff Bezos variety, who's played by Justin Theroux, is emblematic of nothing specific to fashion glossies. It is just a kind of rant about the state of the industry. And that wouldn't be a deal breaker precisely if the rest of the movie was a little more compelling. Andy has this half-baked romantic subplot that the film like simply forgets about for long stretches of time. It's like this guy shows up about halfway through the movie and then a couple more times. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's right. She wants to date him, I guess. I guess they're into each other. I don't know. But that is kind of symbolic of Andy's own life, which I'm curious to get your guys' take on this. There's this very weird moment where she refers to her frozen eggs as her children. And I can't tell if that's supposed to like, it feels like a very sad thing. It just felt like a very sad thing. I don't know. Emily Blunt reprises her role as Emily Charlton. And her life is actually much more interesting, right? She works at Dior now. She's left Runway. She works at Dior. She's dating the Bezos-esque billionaire. She has a plan that we see come to fruition as the movie goes along. But we don't spend enough time with her. She just is there to kind of move the story along. The film is frequently pretty charming. I didn't hate it or anything. But it's charming in the way a lot of franchise fare is charming. I like these characters. I like these actors. It's fun to see where they are two decades later. But it's generic and it's slight. And I think it has less to say about the world of journalism than it thinks it does. I don't know. Alyssa, what did you make of The Devil Wears Prada 2?
This is a movie that I cannot address objectively in any given way. And the reason is that it is about, it is, and really not in a remotely subtle way, it is about what Jeff Bezos did to the Washington Post and, you know, what, and the fantasy that someone would save it. And the level of detail in the movie that presents Benji Barnes as Bezos and his wife, Sasha Barnes, as Mackenzie Scott, is really striking if you have followed both of their sort of lives so far, right? I mean, there is the sort of, there is the divorce. There is the tech billionaire who gets the glow up. But there is, you know, the ex-wife being, just not speaking to the media at all, as Mackenzie Scott does not. There is the ex-wife getting remarried to someone who is extremely low profile and not in the public eye at all, as Ms. Mackenzie Scott did. And there is this real fantasy among some people inside and outside the Washington Post newsroom that, you know, Mackenzie will swoop in and save the paper, as she, you know, sort of has done with a bunch of nonprofits by giving them enormous unrestricted charitable grants. And I just had a really hard time personally with the movie's fantasy, right? I mean, you know, there are a number of people who have died or committed suicide after being laid off from the Washington Post over the past 5 years. You know, the Washington Post won two Pulitzer Prizes today, one for a photojournalist who is not at the paper anymore, who was let go, along with all of the paper's original photojournalists. And, you know, I left the Post 9 months ago, 10 months ago at this point. But I found myself just so raw watching the movie. And just, you know, unintentionally, like, I don't think this is Alan Brosh McKenna's fault. I don't think this is David Frankel's fault. I don't think it's anybody's fault. But I just personally found the fantasy that journalism can be spared the bad billionaires and saved by the good ones just kind of unbearable, given what actually did happen at the Washington Post over the past 10 years, right? You know, the idea that, like, someone, like, the idea that someone's going to, like, swoop in and buy the Post for more than the $250 million Jeff Bezos paid for it is just, like, it's a ludicrous fantasy. He clearly doesn't want to let it go. He's not going to let it go. And, you know, I think the movie is, I found it unexpectedly clear-eyed about the idea that the industry is sort of hanging on for now, right? It is shrinking. There are some people who are making their way onto the lifeboat, but I just can't speak. I cannot evaluate this movie in like a clear-eyed, objective way. I just can't do it. It's too hard for me, if I'm being honest. And I think there are a bunch of interesting things happen in the margins. You know, it is interesting, for example, that while Andy has not had children, like Emily has two kids who she speaks about with pride. We see her on the phone with them, even if it sort of devolves into her fighting with her ex. You know, there is like Miranda is married again, seemingly happily, right? Like there is some, there's some just sort of interesting notes in the movie. I also think the arc with Miranda and Nigel, where she sort of realizes that she has taken him for granted, is bittersweet in a different way than the evocation of the post is bittersweet. I don't know if either of you have read Andre Leon Talley's The Chiffon Trenches, which is his memoir of his time in the fashion industry. He was a sort of protege of Diana Vreeland, who ran Vogue before Anna Wintour did, and worked with Wintour very closely, you know, for much of his life, but felt like he never got credit from her, ultimately sort of died estranged from her in a really painful way. And so there is a, you know, there is an attempt to kind of, you know, in a wistful way, retcon that story too. But yeah, I just, as soon as the movie was over, I just bolted from the theater. It was just too hard. And maybe that's giving the movie more credit. I'm sure that's giving the movie more credit than it deserves, but it was like reliving some really painful moments of my own life in a way that made it just difficult to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that the movie kind of sets up the Bezos character as a, you know, a force of destruction. I did think it felt more like they were going for a Lorraine Powell Jobs analogy with the character who's played by Lucy Liu towards
entirely possibly. Although, you know, I mean, why not have her be another, like a different person then, right? Because like Lorraine Powell Jobs, you know, and the Emerson Collective seem to have done a nice job and been very supportive of The Atlantic, but she is so clearly set up as a Mackenzie Scott stand-in in a way that like the details would just be very, like if Lucy Liu's character was like the widow of a different tech titan, but it really, like the Mackenzie Scott sort of details there are so, the parallel is just like really undeniable.
Yeah. Peter, what did you make of the film's treatment of Andy? Because I think it's this really kind of interesting thing where she is treated in both of these movies as like super idealistic, and then she kind of betrays her principles, but not really. But also, she is just objectively a much bigger mess than, as Alyssa says, either Miranda or Emily. Like she has no life. And it's if you stop and think about it for, I don't know, 10 seconds, it actually is like kind of sad in a way that I don't know that the film intends. And this is why I highlighted that line about the eggs, because I was like, I can't tell if we're supposed to be laughing at her or treating this as like of a fun little character quirk. It was a very weird vibe.
Well, this film is in so many ways a negative image of the first, down to the way that they, you know, structure this film, where in both movies the you know, kind of a capstone scene takes place in the back of a black car. In the first movie, she's wearing that powder blue sweater in the opening act, and in this film we see it in the closing moments, right? This movie just sort of repeats all of the beats of the first film, but on a sadder note, and sort of with the passage of time. And what we were supposed to understand about Andy in this film is that her journey and this movie are about the kind of middle-aged life disappointment of a very particular kind of urban millennial who moved to the big city hoping to get one of the big culture jobs. And in her case, actually did. And right, so she starts at Runway and then sort of makes her way up there. And then we find out there's that little weird bit about she bums around through other countries, and I guess she's reporting in them. I think she says maybe telling stories or something, but then ends up with this job, right? You know, at the end of the last movie, she ends up with a serious job at a real real little newspaper. Very funny that that scene in the first movie was shot in the offices of the old New York Sun, which I know you guys remember. But here she is. She's got the job as, you know, sort of the award-winning serious journalist in New York, and she loses it immediately in that opening scene at the dinner where she's getting the award, you know, and sort of being recognized. But this is the movie about the fantasy being a fantasy, having it pulled out from under you in so many ways. I mean, it is a surprisingly, I don't know if I quite want to say dark, though there is a darkness to it, but it is a surprisingly kind of sad and straightforward movie about middle-aged disappointments, in particular for, like I said, millennials who move to a big city in hopes of getting a big culture job. And even if you got it, even if you landed there in 2006. So I showed up in Washington, D.C. in 2005. And you know what? I worked at first one magazine and then another. And I actually still have that job. I've been working at the same magazine now for 17 years next month. And it's been pretty great. But I know so many people for whom it has not worked out. And even people who still have those jobs. At this point, everybody is looking around thinking, man, this is just deck chairs in the Titanic. It's musical chairs. Who is going to be the last one? And this movie captures that so well. And to two specific points that you made, Sonny, the first one about the eggs, that is related. That is the thing that didn't happen for her, right? I thought that line was really interesting too, because it's so clearly shot to be cut out. It's never referenced again. It's a kind of an insert. The conversation would make total sense if you basically cut that and maybe like one of the lines around it. So like this was an editing decision to keep that movie, to keep that line in the movie that they didn't have to make, but they chose to keep it in because it reflects this. She didn't quite make it, even while making it, even while getting the job that she wanted. And then you have this other bit that you mentioned, Sonny, which is the boyfriend developer. And this is, I think, in some ways, the most interesting little subplot. I agree, it's a little bit, it's not quite that they forget about it, but it's a little bit underwritten here and there, right? Like this movie is trying to do a lot of things. But what do you see in that? When they first meet each other, she is searching for a new apartment or new condo to buy. It's not actually clear whether she's renting or buying. In any case, it doesn't matter. She goes, she's shown this beautiful old building and you see the exterior of it. And it's really nice, beautiful old New York apartment building. And you get in and everything's been refurbed and rehabbed, right? And it's quite nice and new, but she is offended by the newness and niceness of it because it's kind of generic and the same, right? She's like, and it just sort of looks like every other kind of redeveloped place in New York. And she starts ranting to just the guy who happens to be in the room. And oh, it turns out he is the developer, the contractor, he corrects her, but the developer who basically did all of this. And what does he tell her? He tells her, well, the alternative was this building was going to be torn down. And we're supposed to understand that, I don't know if I quite want to say he wins that argument, but he has a real point. She ends up in this place, which again is so funny and so like such a perfect kind of aesthetic economic detail that all of these jobs we have, like magazine jobs, all of these jobs that people are afraid of losing, so tied up in property in very expensive cities, right? So that's part of this. But she ends up moving in. And she ends up dating him. Yes, they have like a little moment of falling out and then they get back together at the end. But in that, we are supposed to understand that he is making at least a reasonable, plausible argument that, look, the world, you can't preserve it in amber forever. We're not going to have the magazine industry of 1995 or 2006. That's just not going to be the case. And in some cases, maybe you need somebody with money to step in and a developer to revitalize these things and make them, and they're not going to be the same. It's just not going to be the same, but that doesn't mean that the world has fallen apart. And so this movie really offers a kind of, I've seen people criticize it for not being kind of anti-capitalist or sort of class war-y enough. This is wrong. This movie is smarter than that. It actually kind of presents both ways of looking at this. On the one hand, something really has been lost, something real and human that mattered. And on the other hand, it's maybe the world, it doesn't necessarily mean that the world is over. The world is, in fact, always changing. That Benji monologue, which we are supposed to understand is a shitty way to look at art, right? That monologue where he's like, Pompeii, you know, it just took over them, right? And like, this, maybe everything will be in the future. There will be no humans involved at all. It's all AI, right? It sounds a little like me sometimes. We're supposed to understand that on the one hand, he's an asshole. We are also, there is some truth to this. There is, like, the world is going to change and we're going to have to accept that.
You know, that monologue did sound like you, but it wasn't that part, Peter. It was the lava is going to flow over everything and our job is just to go with the lava, that bit. The time and the improvement of technology, blah, 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 is like a lava flow and our job is just to go with the lava. And like, that's insane. That's an insane amoral view of the world.
Lava doesn't have morality. He very much loses that.
Interesting thing
I agree that Benji's argument is not supposed to be one that we are supposed to see as fundamentally good and true. I do think that if you pair that with the developer's bit on the apartment building, then you get something that is a little more mixed and a little bit more complicated. And there's also that one other bit with her assistant, where she's like, look, I spent my whole career trying to figure out what people need to know. And now I have to figure out what they want to click on. And her assistant, again, somebody we are supposed to read as a good character, not sort of a jackass, says, you know, maybe the trick is to find things that people need to know that they will also click on, right? Again, this sort of adjustment to a new world is built into this film's ethos in a way that I found pretty fascinating.
Yes, though I can't help but think that the movie is at least slightly critical of Andy for this, right? The first one ends with her kind of rejecting Satan and all her works, right? In like very explicit terms. And in this one, she buys the apartment. In this one, she is probably going to write that book, right? There's a whole subplot about, you know, whether or not she's going to basically stab Miranda in the back for a $350,000 paycheck. Miranda says to do it, because Miranda's the devil. She's the devil wearing Prada. And she'll probably do it. She'll probably do it. She takes the job at Runway, the ridiculous job. You know, she works with Emily to try and steal the magazine out from she thinks she's doing it to save Miranda's job. Emily thinks she's doing it to get the job for herself. And like, what is her big scoop? What's the thing that goes viral, right? She's hired to run this features desk. She's hired to be to turn around the reputation of the magazine. What's her big scoop? She gets an interview with a divorcee and learns out some hot goss about her. She's not saving the fucking rainforest. She's a hack. She's a hack working for a degraded publication doing shitty clickbait work. And like, that is where she winds up. And, you know, again, like, this is there's another speech in the film kind of toward the end where Miranda says something like, Runway is the last piece of floating debris next to the Titanic. And you have grabbed onto it and you should hold onto it for as long as you can. That is, I think that's true. And that's true of a lot of people at a lot of journalism outlets. But it's not a particularly persuasive moral case. And I think, you know, in the original film, Andy is positioned as somebody who is trying to behave morally, even as she is being kind of sucked into this world of fashion. She eventually rejects it all. Now she's just accepted it. And that's what she's going to do. And I think the movie does not treat this as melancholic, but that is a much more melancholic ending than I kind of expected from this picture.
I agree, it's melancholic, but I also think that at the end of the first film, a part of her journey is learning to respect that fashion actually has value. It's not, she comes in thinking that it's silly and frivolous, and maybe it is silly and frivolous in certain ways, right?
Totally.
The film is about her learning that these things have, that yes, her view, her romantic view of serious journalism, where you report on the janitors' unions, is that matters. The movie like sort of says, like, this is important stuff. You got to do the real meat and potatoes stuff, the vegetables, but also this frothy, fizzy, bubbly stuff that you think that you make fun of and you look down on. actually, it's really important too. And this movie simply reflects that she has already learned that lesson.
Yeah, yeah, but the problem is that she doesn't break a big fashion story. She doesn't change how people look at Dior or Coach or anything. She interviews a divorced woman and gets some gossip, and then it goes viral. She's not, and this is why I was saying earlier, this could be about any publication. Like, there's nothing in anything she does that is relevant specifically to the world of fashion. And that's a weakness of the film, at least compared to the first. Alyssa, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
What were you?
No, I think that's right to a certain extent. I mean, I think the movie is very interesting about the sort of the class position of journalists, right? Because, you know, journalism used to be a trade. It was something you could do, you know, that people could and often did do without a college education. It was not particularly well remunerated, nor was there necessarily an expectation that it would be. And I think that, like, part of what this movie is grappling with is the downward mobility of journalism sort of from its peak, right? And I think what the movie doesn't quite grapple with that would have been interesting is, like, the question of whether Andy is going to stay in journalism at all if this job at Runway doesn't work out, right?
There's one line about it basically at the beginning when she's talking to her art friend who offers her a job at like writing copy for the gallery. And she's like, no, I don't want that job yet.
Yeah. And, you know, the first movie is her kind of on her way up, right? You know, there's the sort of final scene with her boyfriend where she's like, you know, and I have the screenplay here. Nate, you were right about everything. I turned my back on my friends, my family, on everything I believed in. And for what? And he responds, shoes and jackets and belts, right? Like, she is someone who got seduced by the lifestyle. But then the question the second movie doesn't quite pose is, like, what if those are the only places left where you can do anything even sort of close to substantial? You know, and she is throwing a line to other people, right? Like, she's hiring people from her old job. You know, and again,
she hires John Bresnahan. Did you guys, the guy with the New York Yankees cap, Brez, if you're listening, but it's very funny because I was like, wait a second, that's literally John Bresnahan. What's happening here?
Yeah. But I think just the question of, like, the shrinkage of the industry, like, and the, you know, the ambiguous class position of journalists. Again, I found it very melancholy, but also just, like, don't trust me one way or another on this movie. It was too close to home.
All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Devil Wears Prada 2? Peter?
It didn't hit me in the same way or with the same impact that Alyssa did. It hit Alyssa, but I was surprisingly moved by this film, again, for sort of personal reasons. But I also just think it's, like, quite well done for what it is and surprisingly honest. So thumbs up.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up, but if you're a former Washington Post employee, maybe go see it with a friend so you have someone to talk to about it afterwards.
Boy, I am very torn on this movie because I think it has lots of problems that are endemic. Like, I think it is just poorly conceived kind of throughout, and it's not nearly as it doesn't move as well as the first. It does nothing as well as the first one, I'll put it that way. And yet, like franchise, like a Marvel movie, I was just happy to be with these characters again. I like them. I like them all. So I give it a very hesitant thumbs up, but it's a real mess. And I think it thinks it's a little smarter than it is, which is a problem for a movie like this. The first one was very smart about fashion journalism. This is kind of dumb about journalism in general. But it's not about the
business of it. I mean, we haven't talked about the Emily subplot at all, or the relationship with Dior, which is portrayed in, like, quite a biting and I think pretty revealing way. Right.
Yes. Like, well, and again, you know who doesn't leave her job at Runway when this happens right in front of her? Andy. Because she's accepted the devil's bargain. Anyway, neither here nor there. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieaisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.